Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Baudrin. And on the show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We'll break kayfabe on sports, movie, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we are going to discuss Gordon Solie. Gordon Solie, who, in my humble opinion, has to be included on the Mount Rushmore of great wrestling announcers of all time. I don't think that's a really out there statement that tons of people are going to disagree with. We are incredibly fortunate and honored to have with us today as a guest, Pam Allen, who is the daughter of Gordon Solie. Pam, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Afternoon. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much. And we are so honored to have you to discuss your father's life and a book that you did in conjunction with your husband, Bob, and Gordon himself, called Something Left Behind, which is, for anybody that is interested in reading any kind of book on wrestling or wrestling history, especially anyone that's a fan of your father, I think it's a must have. And so we're going to discuss that book in some detail. But Pam, first of all, let me just ask you, memories of your father growing up, as a young girl with your father. When did you first come to realize that your father was, you know, not just dad, but he was Gordon Solie, wrestling announcer?
You know, people have asked that numerous times, and to be honest with you, I don't think I ever realized it. He was just my dad. You know, I mean,
sure.
He was his dad.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and I think people on the streets as I got older, you know, we'd walking down the street or something, and people would say, Mr. Solie, Mr. Solie. And I thought, wow, he knows a lot of people, you know, but he always was like that. I mean, my dad never met a stranger. I mean, he could talk to anybody about anything for lengths of time. I mean, as a friend of mine says, I apparently have that same trait. He goes, you have a lot to say. And my dad had a lot to say. So that's who he was. I don't remember any particular moment. He was just, like I said, my dad.
Well, I mean, did you ever, were you ever in a situation at school or something like that where someone ever approached you and said, wow, I can't believe your dad is Gordon Solie?
Actually, when my parents divorced, my mother moved us to Illinois out of the state of Florida. And of course, everybody's talking about their dads at school. You know, this is grade school. And I said, well, my dad's on TV. And I had kids look at me and go, oh, you're a liar. And I'm like, okay, how do you come back to that? And I said, no, he really is. And they said, yeah, right. Well, it wasn't until probably maybe 25 years ago that people started going, my gosh, your dad really is on TV. I'm like, yeah, that's what I said when I was like 10 or 11 and nobody believed me. So, this was Illinois and they had Chicago wrestling. They didn't have, and of course we had like three channels. You know, on TV.
I remember those days.
Yeah. So how was I going to prove it? I couldn't.
Sure. So do you have any, you know, because you were living with your mom, did you ever have a chance to, you know, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, to observe your dad working?
Yes, many times. Up until my parents' divorce, I mean, he was not afraid to take me down to the sportatorium. I mean, I knew Eddie, I knew Mike, used to skip rocks with Mike on the bay, on Sunday afternoons when dad had like the visitation before the divorce, you know, he'd take us over there. And, Don Curtis was a frequent visitor at the house before my parents' divorce. Cowboy Luttrell. I mean, everybody had this, like he was this hard, gruff man. No, I mean, he always took the time. I remember him, you know, like bending over and how are you doing? Cause I was a little girl. They treated me like a little lady, you know, and that's what my dad expected, that I act like a lady when I was in there. But no, I went to the races with him when he would announce. And I thought that was pretty awesome. I probably thought that was more awesome than the wrestling.
Now just for an age comparison, you know, were you the same age as Mike Graham or younger or older or what?
No, we're the same age.
Same age. Okay. Yeah. So did you know Belinda, Belinda Luttrell?
Not until recently. Maybe I met her back in the day, but I don't remember. I don't remember. I just remember going and sitting in Cowboy's office as a little girl, and they were talking wrestling, and I didn't understand what they were saying because, you know, that was business. I remember going to the Jefferson Hotel with my dad because that was where the office was. So there's a lot of, like, patches of memory that pop up, and the most important ones were the ones where it was just dad and me going to, like, the races or, you know, the Strawberry Festival and stuff like that, so...
So now let's get to the book. You decided to write the book, and this was a few years ago, but it still resonates with me. I had read it when I first bought it, and I had a chance to pick it up recently and was going through. And the book is called Gordon Solie, Something Left Behind. Why did you decide to do this, as you know, besides, of course, wanting a fond remembrance of your father?
Well, there's another side to my dad that a lot of people never saw, but he was a very talented writer. Away with words, and not just speaking them, but on paper. And Something Left Behind is one of two books, actually. There is a second book. But that one, Something Left Behind, are his writings, and he left them behind. And when he, before he passed away, he said, I'm going to leave you all my writings. And then he kind of got that smirk on his face. And I said, yeah. And he goes, you'll know what to do with them. I said, well, that's a pretty vague statement. What am I supposed to do with them? He goes, you'll know what to do. And when I got all the writings together, because he had them all in this envelope, I mean, he planned it out, and big envelope. And going through them, it was like I saw a side of my father I did not know existed, this tender side, this, this hard side that he was, you know, traveling on the road. It basically is a chronological composite of his entire life, you know, from the get-go. My parents divorced, and he talks about that in there, and moves into his time on the circuit for the Thrill Show, which he really enjoyed doing that. Because he didn't have a... Wrestling wasn't a full-time job, because in the summer, they didn't do it. You know, this was it. So he'd go out on the road and do the Thrill Show and travel around the country, so we didn't get to see him a lot. I mean, but when he was home, you know, as far as having the job at WFLA. And then he got the opportunity at Golden Gate Speedway and Sunshine Speedway and Phillips Field. I mean, all that stuff just kind of like, boom, happened.
You know, one of the things is, as I looked at the book, that I'd like to ask you, to certain people that will listen to this show that are, of course, wrestling fans, this may almost seem like a sacrilegious question to ask, but I almost got the feeling reading this that wrestling was not your father's true love and passion. Stock car racing was. Would that be fair?
You are. Yeah. And that is a lot of people, but it was. I mean, my dad had a lead foot to begin with. OK, if you've ever driven with him, you held on to the side of the door and the sissy bar at the front of his car. And he'd go, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, you're crazy. He's just driving down the road. But he would put his seat back. He'd have the seat back, and he was gone. I mean, he loved it. I think he was a risk taker. That was part of what attracted him to it. You did not call his house or make any plans on Sundays when NASCAR was running. Because he would not answer the phone. He did. You would hear about, don't you call my house right now. I'm busy. The race is on. So, he did, because Dad liked calling the action. And to him, that was a story a lot like wrestling. But nobody was, and I'm trying to figure out a nice way to say this. He didn't know the outcome of the race. Okay, he didn't know the outcome of the wrestling matches either, because nobody ever told him. I mean, he just went in and went blind with it. You know, he just called it as he saw it. But racing to him, that was in his blood. I mean, that was just, and I don't know where that came from, because his dad, his stepfather, wasn't into racing. My grandmother certainly wasn't into racing. And so I don't know where it came from. He was a risk taker.
Well,
I guess.
And
I don't know.
When he got to Tampa, you know, Tampa, of course, at the time, I'm sure because there wasn't any professional sports teams at the time that your dad was coming there. Stock car racing and wrestling were the two big things probably in that area, correct?
Yeah, they were the thing. That and golf, because I know Babe Zacharias. He knew the Zacharias family, George Zacharias, and it definitely was. He was drawn to the stock car races. Make matters worse if he knew the inside of an engine and all that, but he couldn't fix any of them. I mean, it'd take him fixed, but he could tell you what made it work and what made it run, you know? I mean, he was an amazing person.
Well, and, you know, the other thing that I find fascinating about the book, and, you know, here, people that are fans of your father, like myself, you know, we know him as being the guy on either Georgia or Florida wrestling who's calling the match. And, you know, I personally grew up and became a wrestling fan listening to your father call Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. matches. And it was always Dory Funk hanging on at the end of the match as Jack had the figure four applied. And he had such a way with words. And, you know, it shouldn't have been surprising, but in the book, as you said, you reveal some of your father's writings. And not just he wrote short stories, but your father wrote poetry, which I find just incredibly interesting.
And it was beautiful poetry, too.
It really is, yes.
It's not femmy poetry like most people think. I mean, this is like really good stuff. I mean, he does 7 Days from Rome. I mean, my gosh, that could be happening right now. The Red and Green, I think it's Red and Green, that's the Fair Life, you know, I mean, and the Flies on the Bar. I mean, all this stuff. I mean, he wrote all the time. And what people don't realize is that my dad didn't sleep much at night. And apparently I've actually taken that trait on myself, but his mind was constantly going, and he would write on anything and everything. He'd write on tile. He'd write on napkins. I remember going through his jackets and finding pieces of napkins with partial stuff on it. I mean, he just wrote. I mean, and it was like he said, I just can't stop my mind. It's just always going. And out of that came all of those writings, and they're beautiful.
And it shows him to be, you know, when I first read the book, the term that came to me is he's a bit of a bon vivant, you know, I mean, a man of the world, if you will. And that is certainly reflected in his writings, his poetry. And it makes you see him as so much more than Gordon Solie wrestling announcer or Gordon Solie stock car announcer, and presents such a different side of him that, you know, you really have to wonder if Cowboy Luttrell and Eddie Graham really understood that there was that part of your father.
Oh, I think Cowboy did for sure. In fact, Cowboy kind of stepped in and became like Dad's dad. Dad tells the story of one time he was at a party, and I guess Dad and Eddie were getting out a little out of control. And of course, now, you know, it's my saying this, okay, because they're really not here to defend themselves.
Of course.
But Cowboy backed my dad up against the wall and says, you need to stop. And my dad was like, okay, I'm done. And then he said that scared him to death. He said he didn't want to make Cowboy angry because he respected him. You know, that was like his father. And Eddie was like his brother. I mean, when Eddie passed away, that devastated Dad. I mean, it really brought him down. I don't think he ever got over it.
Well, you know, here's an analogy that I'll use. I always felt that your father, because, as you said, he did not know the result of the match going in and calling it, he called it as what they would call a shoot or a legitimate contest. And that's part of what made his call so great. And I always felt that as your father and the promotion aged into the middle part of the 80s and on beyond that, and let's just say the promotion was beginning a downslide after Eddie's death, I thought, whether it was a conscious thing or not, I thought that your father's performance as an announcer also began to suffer because the product that he was pushing wasn't as good. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Yeah, and it wasn't the same product. It had changed. I mean, he didn't like the changes. He saw the changes coming, and you know, the paradigm was shifting, and he didn't enjoy that. I mean, I remember him saying to me, I think it was the NWO was doing one of the matches where they used a crucifix. That did not set well. He goes, oh, no, this is going completely in the wrong direction, you know, because he admired the wrestlers for who they were as far as they took care of their bodies, they worked out, and, you know, if someone were to say to Dad, it's all fake, he'd go, well, come on, let's go. I want to take you down. We'll go down to the gym. You work out with them for a while. These guys take care of themselves. And then when all the steroid stuff came in, and I mean, that just, yeah, he didn't like it. No. And it changed how he felt about the industry. He didn't watch it like he used to. And I think that's why he looked out for like Continental when the other independents were still thriving to an extent before being taken over or run out of business, he would go to those, and that was where he got his fix again for wrestling, you know, because those were new guys coming up, you know, and he hoped that they didn't fall into that same pit that the rest of the guys had fallen into.
Did your, father? Oh, no, I completely understand. Did your father ever, you know, as you got older, speak to you about the wrestling business? I guess not asking you if he's quote smartened you up, but I mean, did he discuss who he liked, who he enjoyed watching and who he didn't, other than the particular thing you talked about with the crucifix?
There were times. Yeah. I think a lot of that, the stories are in the second book, which is the Soli Chronicles, which, by the way, I put a plug in for, but it's still available. Oh. And Scott Teal is our publisher and sure, is also part of the writing team. But he didn't like the way Vince was taking things.
Okay.
He didn't like it when it went from, it was a sport, so to speak, and then it went to entertainment, and he didn't like that. I mean, that bothered him because, like I said, he made sure he knew all the parts of the body. He knew the anatomy in and out. He knew the history of wrestling, you know, and he would talk about that. But as far as like talking about individuals, I know who he liked. If he didn't like somebody, my dad was the last one to say anything, because he didn't want to. His job was to put them over. That was his job.
Yeah.
He had to put them over. So to come out and say that he didn't like so-and-so, he would never do it. He may not do business with them. And that was kind of his way of just walking away from them. But
just as an example, tell me a wrestler that he enjoyed or liked.
Oh, Jack Briscoe.
Okay.
Yeah, and Curtis.
And of course,
I mean, I could go on and on.
No, you're Jack Briscoe and Don Curtis. You're talking about two guys with obviously legitimate backgrounds at Oklahoma State and I believe Syracuse. So, you know, two guys that were represented the industry as, you know, legitimate athletes, not just, you know, characters.
Yeah. And Jerry Briscoe. I mean, the Briscoe brothers were, I mean, Dad loved them. He just thought they were great people. Don Curtis, off and on with Dusty. And I think that went back to business practices. Eddie, definitely. There's a lot of them.
Sure.
A lot that he really enjoyed.
Yeah, and your father, of course, and Dusty are so sort of historically joined at the hip because I think they both, in a way, expanded each other's brand name, for lack of a better way of putting it. Your father made Dusty, and in doing so, Dusty made your father into a national name.
Well, and the same thing, I'll tell you one that he absolutely, I mean, he was thrilled to work with, and that was Roddy Piper.
Of course.
They had such, I don't know, they could play off each other so well, you know, and it's funny because where I work, I have a poster that Roddy signed for me, and it's on my wall in my office, and the kids will come in the office and go, "Do you know that guy?" I'm like, "Well, yeah. Oh my gosh, you know?" And I'm like, "Yeah." But I mean, that was probably one of his favorites, right up there with Jack and Jerry and Lou Fez. Was very tight with Lou Fez.
Well, I was going to say, getting back to Roddy Piper before I talk about Lou Fez with you, Roddy Piper, your father was basically a perfect straight man for Roddy and basically would serve up the pitches for Roddy to knock out of the park on TV.
And they were so good at it. Their timing was perfect. I mean, the delivery was great.
And one of the things that I loved about your father is your father had the ability to say so much with just the proverbial withering stare and the, you know, the tisk tisk of disdain at the heels. And it without saying anything, it conveyed so many different messages.
Try being the child on the other end of one of those stairs. doesn't, I mean, you know you're in trouble and it's like, uh-oh, you know.
Well, all I'll say is my own personal life, my mother could say more with a raised eyebrow than any 20 words.
Yeah, well, Dad had a way of, I mean, he was totally just like, "Oh my gosh, I'm done." He would just drop his head. And you knew you were in trouble with that one too. It's like, uh-oh, what have I done? You know, I mean, it's just, but he was always very quick with the words back too. I mean, I don't remember, I think, I mean, even you're talking about like, well, I'm going off on this a little bit, talking about discipline. I only remember once where my father actually disciplined me with, you know, a spanking, because I was a little girl and the little boy that lived behind us, you know, in Florida, you got rotten oranges, right?
Sure.
They fall off a tree and they're nasty. I mean, they're nasty. Well, we'd have orange fights as little kids. And the last thing you want to do is get an orange splattered all over you. And so the little boy that lived behind us, who was my best friend at the time, he was throwing rotten oranges at me. And I said, you keep throwing oranges at me, I'm going to throw a rock at you. And he threw another orange. So I threw a rock. And I cut his eye open on the side. And, I mean, it was like, I mean, it wasn't huge, but it was pretty bad. And I remember my father coming out that door, and he just had this look on his face like, oh, this is it. I mean, and all the way in the house, it was 1, 2, 3. He goes, don't you ever do that again. He never had to spank me again. I was like, no, thank you. I don't want this. He would prefer to talk. You know, this is why you don't do this kind of stuff, you know. Very, I think he was trying to shock me that time. Like, don't ever do that again.
Sure.
I didn't.
So, well, that's good to know. So you had also mentioned your father's affection for Lou Thesz.
Yeah, and again, very much
again,
so.
And Lou Thesz, again, legitimate background, and was sort of a bridge from yesterday to the more modern wrestling. And I'm sure that's when your father was first coming into prominence as an announcer, Lou Thesz was the world champion and certainly presented the sport of wrestling, not the, you know, the entertainment of wrestling.
It was the sport of wrestling, yes. And that St. Louis link, you know, I mean, there was like the little fingers out there, and it kind of drew in from everywhere. And Florida territory was huge. I mean, as far as like reached out to everything, and people were drawn to that area. Like you said, it was booming in that time frame. And Lou was probably out of all of them, he was the one that everybody looked up to, that everybody wanted to be like Lou Thesz.
Well, because he presented such a figure of respect. Yeah, and rightfully so. He earned it. But, you know, he was one of those guys who, when he walked into a dressing room, much like a Jack Briscoe or a Don Curtis, just commanded respect because you knew he was legitimate.
Yep. He was the real thing.
Absolutely.
He was. And even going over to Japan, when they went over to Japan, I mean, I think there was still, you know, you're going with the sumo wrestlers and all the of wrestling itself. And back again, going to the historical part of wrestling. And I think Dad was happy that was happening. And Hiro Matsuda, I mean, bringing it over to this, you know, his talent over to this country. So there was a lot of good things going on, but there were also powers to be underneath and then in the back rooms that were pulling the rug out from underneath them.
So let me just ask you, we spoke very briefly when we were talking about your father's relationship with Cowboy Luttrell about Eddie Graham. And Eddie Graham was in so many ways also one of the responsible people for your father becoming a national star. And one of the things I've always heard is that Eddie made a point of showing your father different holds. And that this was something your father wanted. He wanted the hold applied to him so he could see where the different pressure points were. Talk a little bit about that and your father's relationship with Eddie.
Okay. And it wasn't just Eddie. It was Coach John Heath as well.
Okay.
Dad said, how am I supposed to call a match if I don't know what the hold is like? You know, and Dad was not an athlete, not at all. But they put him in the ring and they did the holds on him. And Dad said it was tough, you know, he said, and I think that's where he even garnered more respect for the wrestlers, is that he had been through it. So now he could call it and it could be real to him. His relationship with Eddie, like I said, they were like brothers. They came together at a time when Eddie was starting out, Dad was starting out, and they kind of grew up together along the road, you know, and families, and, you know, I don't know. It's hard for me to at times to go back on that one, because not that I don't remember it, because I do, but it was so tough for Dad. I mean, Eddie's death, like I said, really affected him. And Mike was, there was some estrangement from Mike at the time too. So Dad kind of felt like he was being left out of it, I guess. You know, they planned a lot together. I mean, there was a lot of business planning together, and Cowboy was the overseer.
Now, if I could ask you just to share with us a story from your father's book. Your father had noticed that a number of the wrestlers were getting pilot's license to take them to and from the matches. And your father decided sort of on the sly to become one of the boys and to see about getting his pilot's license. Could you share with us the story about the rib that ended up getting played on your father?
Well, he thought he was being real sneaky. And, you know, and to back up a little bit on that, too, is it was really hard for him to get into the mix of being considered one of the boys, okay, because you're the announcer. You're not the wrestler, you know, and I think when they finally started taking it really serious, the dad was meaning to put him over, and they started seeing the results, and the fan club started up, and the wrestlers were becoming more and more popular. Then they saw dad in a different light. But pilot thing, he always wanted to be a pilot. That was his dream as a kid, but he was always too short. And the Air Force wouldn't take him as a pilot. And that goes back to a story that's in the second book of his stint in the Air. Well, he's in the Air Force, but he couldn't be a pilot. So anyway, he took flying lessons, and on his solo flight, unbeknownst to him, the story had gotten out. Dottie Curtis was involved, Don, my stepmother, Smokey, Eddie. I believe the other one was, why was it Sammy Steamboat? Maybe. I don't know.
Yes. That I seem to recall him being part of it.
Yeah. And anyway, they were waiting for him when he came back on his solo flight. I think he did it out of St. Petersburg's airport, and they got him. They got him good. I mean, Tom McEwen was involved in it. I mean, he was a sports writer with the Tampa Tribune. And they did the cutting of the sport coat, or, you know, in the back, and the wings. They had wings for Soli, and I mean, it was a wonderful time. I mean, they greatly enjoyed it. They were all very close people as far as friends, and I don't know how much the pictures are worth more than the story, because pictures are amazing.
I think one of the things that it showed was, as you said, because he was the announcer in a very closed society, the cutting of his jacket sort of signified an acceptance into that closed society, I believe.
That was his hazing, yes.
And his hazing was accepting him.
Absolutely, absolutely. And things changed from then on. I mean, he really felt a lot more comfortable about it. I mean, it's like, this is my place, you know? I mean, not too many people get up every day and want to go to work. My dad did.
Yeah. So as you became, you discussed that your parents had got divorced when you were young and you went to Illinois. At what age did you sort of become part of your father's life again?
In 1971, moving back to Florida. And of course, we lived down there for 28 years. And then becoming back, you know, that's when. But the last, actually, I think the closest we became, the closer we became was 2 years, was right before my stepmother died. And dad was by himself, you know, and because she was sick. And then when she passed away, he and I got very, very close. And he said it was bittersweet because he'd lost her, but he'd gotten me back. And he was, you know, my kids and with Bob and all that. I mean, it was very, it was good. I mean, everybody, all the kids were together. I mean, including Smokey's kids. And the last 2 years of his life, I became his primary caregiver. And we would go up on Wednesday nights. I would fix meals like Grouper Almondine or his love for spaghetti. We had recipes from downtown Tampa, you know, restaurants that go way back into the 50s. And I would fix dinner and we'd drive it up there and I'd walk in and he'd have the dining room table set with the fine china and the wine glasses and the candles. And I'm like, what the heck? And he goes, we're going to eat in style. I mean, and so we did. I mean, and we enjoyed those nights. And on Saturdays, not on Sundays, on Saturdays, we would go up to Cricketers and we'd play trivia. At first I thought, He said, well, you want to go to this, my favorite watering place, watering hole? I said, sure. So we went up there, and he told Lady, he says, hey, come here. He says, bring that box over here. Because he knew I liked trivia, because I love playing trivia games. And he put the box down. He said, what is this? And he goes, well, you didn't think I brought you over here to feed you, did you? I said, what are you talking about? I need you to help me win on trivia. So that became our thing. We'd go to Cricketers and we'd play trivia, and between the two of us, we would win. And if I got an answer wrong, you know, that look of disdain, oh, I would get that. And he'd say, well, I could have answered that one. I'm like, no, you couldn't. That's why he looked at me like, yeah, you can answer it, Pam. But we became a lot closer. And
your father had a little bit of a competitive streak there in the trivia games, huh?
Oh, yeah. Well, Scrabble. Try playing Scrabble with him. I mean, he was mean on Scrabble, but he knew words. I mean, he had a thing. He would say, you know, if you take a word and you use it 13 times a day or something like that, I forget the number, but he says, you use it all day long. Use it in sentences. It becomes your word. And then it's imprinted in your head forever. And he would learn a new word every day. And if you listen to any of the wrestling calls or the shows, you'll hear it, because he just throws a word out there. People said they didn't know some of those words until Dad started saying them.
One of the things, as we start to wrap up here, that I found so much about the book, Something Left Behind, and I'm sure is also a part of the Soli Chronicles, which, as Pam said, is available at crowbarpress.com through our friend Scott Teal. Is that your father really wasn't just a wrestling announcer. And as much as that he was identified with that, duly, absolutely should have been, but he was so much more a man of the world. And I think, you know, I'm sure as his daughter, you don't remember your father as, you know, the wrestling announcer. You remember him as the man of letters, the man of poetry, and so much more.
Yes. Yeah. He, like I said, he was my dad, and I'm honored that, you know, that I was allowed to be his child. I really am. It's like, I learned so much from him, and there are times I look at my own kids and I see my dad coming out and I'm like, oh boy. I mean, it may be that risk taker side or that poetry side or that drama. My dad did drama in high school. He was on stage in high school, and a lot of people don't realize that, but he was very good at what he did. But he was also that he could be that hellion when he wanted to be.
Yeah. And, you know, very well, subconsciously, that time spent on stage when something needed to get over on the broadcast, and he needed to throw a little extra to accentuate his point. You know, I'm sure that drama education and the drama skills certainly probably helped him out at that point.
Oh, I'm sure it did. I'm sure it did.
Knowing how to sell an angle.
Oh, he was a salesman. Yes, salesman.
Well, and he did a great job of selling not only championship wrestling from Florida, but championship wrestling, Georgia Championship Wrestling, Continental Wrestling, This Week in Pro Wrestling, when he was co-hosting with Joe Pedicino, and then later as he moved into to WCW. And, you know, it's funny, as your father's generation of fans, as they age, as I mentioned, I remember your father calling Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. So many of the fans that are out there on the internet now, they remember your father for the famous line, two words,
I quit.
And, You know, what Something Left Behind and the Soli Chronicles show is that your father was so much more than just a wrestling announcer. And I encourage all of you to read Pam's book, The Soli Chronicles, from crowbarpress.com with our friend Scott Teal. And Pam, I want to just say how much I really, really appreciate you coming on the show and talking about your dad with us.
I thank you very much for thinking of me, and I'm sure that he's looking down going, okay, Pam, now you can be quiet. And so long from the, Tar Heel State. Thank you.
And welcome back to Breaking Kayfabe, a special part two of Breaking Kayfabe. I'm Jeff Bowdrin. Joining me now is my old friend Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
I'm doing great, man. Thanks for having me back. I know today we're going to discuss something that is near and dear to my heart.
Near and dear to both our hearts. We're getting away from wrestling First of all, I want to say again a special shout out and a special thanks to my friend Pam Allen, who joined us in part one discussing her father, the late Gordon Solie. And that was a great interview, and I really appreciate her time. But Barry and I are going to switch gears here a little bit. We're going to talk about movies, which is a subject that's near and dear to both our hearts. Today, we are going to discuss our favorite Stephen King movies, and we're also, at the end of today's episode, we're going to be discussing one that is not one of the best thought of Stephen King movies, but one that is completely near and dear to both our hearts for a lot of reasons. But first of all, what we're going to discuss is the best Stephen King movies. So Barry, why don't you start out with number 3, 2, 1 on your list. Give me your top three Stephen King movies of all time.
Gotcha. Definitely too. So what's the criteria that we're looking for? Are we looking for the three movies that Stephen King has been associated with, which would generally be considered the best movies, or my three favorites, which probably would be at the bottom of a list? So what would be the criteria for that?
Well, I was thinking the three best, but if you want to throw your three favorites out there, I understand that's not always the same thing. So go ahead.
It really isn't, too. I'll say this, though. I think my favorite Stephen King movie that is universally thought of as a very good movie is probably Misery. And, you know, I do tend to like the Stephen King Creepshow and Cat's Eye, these more B type of movies. As opposed to the Stephen King movies, which really like Shawshank Redemption, which is a fantastic movie. But I think Misery is probably my favorite. And I really like the horror aspect of it. And I remember when I saw Misery, which, if I'm correct, was about 90 or 91. And I remember sitting in the theater and that scene, and I guess we're going to do a few spoilers here, but, you know, hey, it's been, what, 27 years, so I guess it's okay.
Yeah, if you haven't seen it yet, yeah, that's not on us.
Right. And on that note, the Bible says, right, so there's spoilers, but the scene where Kathy Bates hobbles James Caan, and I remember being in the theater, and I think I like doubled over in my seat when that happened. And part of it was, I don't think I'd ever seen that before, but the acting from both James Caan and Kathy Bates was just phenomenal in that movie. So I'm going to say Misery. Yeah, it's really hard for me to go 1, 2, 3. So I'm going to give you my top three. I'll say it's Misery. I'm going to say Shawshank Redemption, and I'm going to say Green Mile. Yeah, no, but that's tough, though, because he also did The Shining. So where, I don't know. This is one of these, and I'm such a big Stephen King fan, for good, bad, or ugly, that it's really, really tough for me. I'll say those four. I know you said 1, 2, 3, and you know me, I've been breaking rules since we were kids, Jeff, but Misery, Green Mile, Shawshank Redemption, and the Shining would be my top four that I think are the best Stephen King movies. Maybe not necessarily my favorite, which we'll discuss in a little bit, but I would say those are the best.
Okay. So here's where I'm going. I'm going for my top three, as I sat and thought about this, and one of them you did not mention that immediately jumped to the top of mine was the recent release of Stephen King's It, which I just, you know, I have to be honest with you. Truth be told, I'm not a huge horror movie fan. My daughter tries to seek out a horror film literally on a monthly, if not weekly basis. And she's into this stuff like The Conjuring and all the, you know, jump out of your seat kind of movies. What I really liked about It, and it also is indicative of another movie that I'm going to bring up, and I'll just come out and say it, The Shining is also in my top three. And both of them, there's a sense of dread that just permeates throughout the movie. Like you keep just waiting for something bad to happen. And to me, that is so brings the viewer into the movie so much more than just having, you know, some scene where a cat jumps out and you jump out of your seat and you're scared for 3 seconds, just for a looming sense of dread. It just, you know, the whole time during the movie, these kids, you just felt like something bad's really fixing to happen to these kids. And Alexander Skarsgård is the actor that plays Pennywise the clown in this movie. And
that's actually, it's his brother Bill.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're correct.
Yeah, so Alexander was True Blood, and their father is Stellan Skarsgård.
Yes, who's tremendous also. He's
right, exactly. The family, they're unbelievable.
Yes. And so anyway, I did not think that Tim Curry could be top. Tim Curry was Pennywise in the miniseries, which now just comes off to me as extremely dated. But he was tremendous in that role. But Skarsgård and his version of Pennywise the Clown, I think he creates more of a sense of menace. And what he does, for those who haven't seen it, and this isn't really a big spoiler, is he forces all the characters to confront what really scares them most. And every person has that thing that scares them most. I mean, you know, my daughter, she's afraid of spiders, like nobody else's business. And, you know, so, I mean, that's just an example of somebody, you know, like my wife doesn't like cockroaches or lizards or something like that. Every person has something that scares them more than any other particular thing. And in this movie, he faces each character and forces them to confront what scares them the most. And that really, to me, presents a different side of evil. And then it presents the nature of evil and what really is evil. And as Barry and I have discussed at an earlier time, one of the things that is particularly interesting to me about that movie is the fact that every adult in the movie, with one minor exception, embodies what is evil and embodies what creates fear within the young characters in the film.
Yeah, that's a really, really excellent analysis of the movie too. And there are several movies where it's like that, where the kids are essentially the protagonists and the adults are all bad. But you said something a couple of minutes ago that I really want to kind of circle back and go back to that. And when it's discussing The Shining, and you really touched on it. The Shining to me is a very, very slow moving movie as well. This is not something that, you know, it's not a roller coaster ride by any stretch, but it is the atmosphere of that movie. And really, I think the success of The Shining, which is one of the creepier horror movies, in my opinion, of all time. It's not, you know, it's not a Freddy, it's not a Jason or a Michael Myers. It's not something like that. But really, it's two things. I think Jack Nicholson was incredible in that movie. And I'm not like a, you know, smoke up the butt guy for Nicholson. But at the same time, I don't know who else could have done what he did so convincingly and believably. The second is it's Kubrick. You know, he directed a movie. It's a work of art. It is beautiful. It is slow moving, but I think a lot of that is what actually makes it work, is that the fact that, you know, you can sit back and you can watch when they're in these long vacant hallways and it's spooky. There's not a sound.
And I think one of the things that I was going to say is, you know, Nicholson is so identified with this film and the, you know, whole "here's Johnny," which, by the way, was not in the book, but he's not what makes the movie scary. The hotel itself is a character in the movie, and the hotel itself plays a part in what makes the film so eerie. What gives you here's this phrase again, that sense of dread that permeates the film.
Yeah, did you ever hear these stories, too, of how they used to torment Shelley Duvall during the making of The Shining?
I did not hear that.
So I guess in hindsight, knowing that she has severe mental illnesses now and is being exploited by Dr. Phil, allegedly exploited by Dr. Phil and a few others, the National Enquirer, et cetera. But apparently they used to isolate her during the movie and they would insult her. Stan Kubrick did. He would insult her. He would talk down to her. She would break down on a daily basis in tears, and they really tormented her. And I guess, you know, in his defense, and I'm not quite sure this is a defense, he was trying to get the best performance from her. But I guess he really played into her psyche, you know, as far as insulting her, talking about her looks, and really just laying into her. And obviously, some, you know, 30, 40 years later now, she is fighting these severe mental illnesses, which is a real shame. But I was at a fan fest, and you and I have talked about this. As much as I go to wrestling fan fests, I also go to these horror movie conventions, and I was at one, 6-7 months ago, and they do these Q&A panels. It's very similar to what you do with our wrestling fan fests, and there was a Q&A panel with the twin girls and the little boy, Jack Nicholson's son from the movie, and I got to admit, it was It was riveting. It was especially creepy. And my son, my 16-year-old son that I've started showing movies, and we haven't seen The Shining yet, but after watching this, the first thing he says is, can we go home tonight? Can we watch The Shining? Because he was so taken. And these little girls who are now probably 50 years old, really short, they're still identical twins, but they're still a little bit creepy. You know, there's like this creepiness factor there. Absolutely. The boy turned out fine, though. He's a teacher like in Texas or something like that. But it's kind of cool because they were all little kids during the filming of this movie. And here they are. They're talking about everything that went on, what they were actually exposed to. So I'm a big fan of The Shining. And I love the fact that you talk. The hotel really is the star. You know, to me, it's the hotel and Jack Nicholson. But I think the director really did a fantastic job with that.
Well, what's interesting is Stephen King has been on record as saying that he completely hated the version of The Shining that Kubrick did, mainly because Stephen King felt like basically Stanley Kubrick took the outline of the story and recreated the story, because Stephen King was quoted as saying that he felt like the character that he had written in his book, The Shining, was not the same as the character that Shelley Duvall played in the film, The Shining. And that he felt that there were, you know, I think he was quoted as saying that the Shelley Duvall character was essentially a rag doll. And, you know, it wasn't the character that he had, the way he had written her. So, but it's still an absolute must see for anyone that's a film, not just of horror films, but of good movies. You adding the creepy door effect there, Barry?
You know, I did that on purpose. I figure if we're going to talk about these types of movies,
freak out the listeners.
Sound effects. You know, this is a really, really high budget show now that you've got going. So yeah, so we can do these sound effects now. Absolutely,
we are sparing no expense in putting these out there. Okay, so I'll go the it Shining, kind of a hyphen there for number three for me. Let me see what else. Who is this? Oh, the second one that you haven't mentioned yet, and I'm a little surprised because here's another one that, you know, people just don't associate with being a Stephen King story, and a story that led to a film by Rob Reiner, and that is Stand By Me. Here they took a Stephen King short story called The Body and created a movie that is probably about as good. You know, you discussed in It how great the kids were and the betrayal of the kids were. Stand By Me, the kids in Stand By Me are so believable, and the acting, River Phoenix, Will Wheaton, just tremendous performances, and it's really one of those movies, you know, that really stayed with me a long time.
Yeah, and it's a fantastic movie, and it's Stephen King had two big movies that came out in 1986, this and a movie that we'll discuss in a few minutes, but it's not a typical Stephen King movie, and I think this is going back to what you were talking about earlier, where, you know, the kids are the heroes, and the adults are all kind of portrayed as villains. And I think this is done purposely from Stephen King on several different movies. But it's a great movie. Is it one of my favorite Stephen King movies? Yeah, I'm not really sure about that.
You know, it's like I said, this is all personal opinion. So now I'm going to go
all
number
subjective.
Exactly. Number one, my number one Stephen King movie, you brought it up very briefly, is Shawshank Redemption. Has to be my favorite Stephen King movie because I have my own personal top 10 favorite movies of all time available to discuss and argue at any time. But Stephen King's The Shawshank Redemption comes in at number 10, as a matter of fact, in my top 10. So I've got to have it number one here. There are so many iconic scenes in this movie. I think that one that particularly stands out is when Tim Robbins escapes from prison, Andy Dufresne crawls through, what was the line, 500 yards of God knows what through the sewer pipe, emerges out of the sewer pipe into the river, and rises almost like in a Christ-like figure with the water cleansing him off as he has finally escaped from Shawshank and begins his life anew.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful movie too. And it, for me, it's not what I typically think of. I don't think anybody would have a typical Stephen King movie. But I think part of it for me too, when I look at movies, how many times can I watch a movie? That to me is the true measure of how much I love a film. And it doesn't mean that, you know, look, there are great, great works of art. And I think Shawshank Redemption falls into fantastic works of art when it comes to film, but I can't sit and watch it. You know, God forbid a movie like Roadhouse comes on TV and I'm there like fucking glue. I sit there, I don't blink, and I can watch it. You know, I watched Fletch the other night, and I must have seen Fletch somewhere around 1,000 times at this point. So for me, the criteria of a good movie is if it's on cable and I see it's on, I immediately stop and I watch it, even if I've seen it 8,000 times. And with Shawshank, I can't do that. Though I will say it's a fantastic movie and it's a fantastic work of art.
You know, you mentioned Roadhouse, and you're going to get me started, you know, first of all, Terry Funk's performance and the great Swayze, you know, Swayze with that hair and Pain Don't Hurt, you know, who can,
I thought you'd be taller. Yeah, it is. Roadhouse is, you know, and I don't want to get off topic with
this. We're
going
to have to devote a whole episode just to
Yeah, we will. The 80s, God bless the 80s. And I get on my knees and I thank God on a daily basis for the horrificness of some 80s music, some 80s movies, 80s clothing and hairstyles. You know, Ricky Morton still rocking the mullet. You know, it's 62 years old, and thank God for that. So I love Roadhouse, but there are certain movies that come out, and you know, again, we're going to talk about one of those movies, which is a Stephen King movie, which is my favorite Stephen King movie. And if that's on cable and I see it's on, it doesn't matter if it's a half an hour into the movie or even the last 15 minutes. I'm going to stop, and I am going to watch it.
Okay, so let's I've got my top, let's say, four like you. You've got a top four out there. So now let's get to the movie that we both acknowledge is not the best Stephen King movie by far. It's quite honestly kind of a big crap fest. It's the only movie that Stephen King ever directed. But when Barry mentioned that afternoon on the weekends, you're sitting there, you're scrolling through the channels, and you look, because it's always on. TNT and TBS always have Maximum Overdrive on at some point during the weekend. And it is a complete just shit show is the best way to put it. But we both just love this movie. Barry, take it. Tell me why you love Maximum Overdrive.
Yeah, so I love Maximum Overdrive probably for the very reasons that Stephen King was promoting the movie. He said it's a moron movie. He said you walk into the theater, you check your brain at the door, and then when you exit the theater, you put your brain back in your head and you can think again. You walk in, it is literally a moron movie. And that's exactly the way that he phrased it. And I love it. You know, from the opening scenes where the bridge is going up and all of a sudden AC/DC starts blaring Who Made Who, and you know, are you putting the bridge up? And the bridge tenors are talking to each other, and the cars and the melons are crashing through the windows. And it's such an iconic, in my opinion, an iconic 80s movie. It requires almost no thought. It's true, but it's a roller coaster ride for me. I have a blast when I see it. You know, I don't want to. There are times you want to think, and you know, I don't want to think if I'm seeing a really good horror movie. Sometimes I just want this visual of something, and it's kind of unique. You know, there aren't a lot of movies that are out there where you know, a comet or something passes overhead and all of a sudden machines come to life. I don't really recall that, so it is kind of unique, and it's definitely original. But you know, Stephen King has gone on record more than once. As you mentioned, the only movie that he's ever directed, and there's actually a wrestling tie-in. You know, the main character's name is Billy Robinson. So there is a very obscure wrestling reference to it. But I love the movie from A to Z, and you know, there's so much that's unique. King has gone on record saying that he was coked out of his mind when he was making this movie, and it shows. You know, it shows that he was definitely on something.
Well, it's funny because there's a great quote from Stephen King when he was asked once why he's never directed a movie since Maximum Overdrive. He said, just watch Maximum Overdrive.
Right.
And, exactly. You know, you talked about the iconic first scene with the bridge going up and all the cars being on it and the melons coming down. To me, the baseball diamond with the kids playing Little League, and here comes the steamroller literally rolling right over the kids. You know, you watch a bunch of Little Leaguers just getting mowed over by a steamroller. It's it just doesn't get any better than that from a completely morbid point of view. But, you know, and you've got great character actors like Pat Hingle playing the owner of the truck stop. It's one of the few movies where
Pat Hingle, who calls everybody Bubba. Come on, Bubba. Just, you know, come on, Bubba.
And you got Yardley Smith, who would later become famous for being the voice of Bart Simpson, who entirely through the movie, it appears like the only thing she ever says is, Curtis!
And here's a little known trivia fact for you. In season 10 of The Simpsons, they actually did an episode that referenced Maximum Overdrive.
I did not know that. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was called Maximum Homer Drive. And it definitely didn't happen. I want to say it was 98 or 99 that happened. Now, here's something else for you. And again, I'm so obsessed with this movie that I know all these obscure facts. Do you know who Stephen King's original choice was to play Bill?
You're talking about the young kid?
Yeah, no. Bill is the Emilio Estevez character.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You know what?
So there was a war between Stephen King and the producer, who was Dino De Laurentiis, very famous from the Superman movies and these big spectacle movies of the 70s. And Dino De Laurentiis was intent that he wanted to use Emilio Estevez, who really was just coming into his own. He had made Repo Man a couple of years earlier and done a couple of small movies, but really Emilio Estevez at this point was kind of an unknown. He hadn't done the Mighty Ducks franchise yet. So Dino De Laurentiis wanted Emilio Estevez. Stephen King wanted somebody. Obviously, Dino won, because it was Emilio in the movie. Who do you think that Stephen King wanted to play that character, which is really the main guy in the movie?
I'm going to go with one of the younger actors out there, Charlie Sheen, Kiefer Sutherland, one of those.
Gotcha. Charlie Sheen, that would have been interesting. Lose the role to your own brother. No, Bruce Springsteen, which makes zero sense in any form. Why he wanted Springsteen, I don't know how that would have played or how that would have worked, but he wanted Springsteen.
Yeah. I had never heard that one. Did you know that the lead heel in the movie, which is a truck, believe it or not, that the imagery on the front of the truck, do you know where they got that image from?
I sure do, man. The Green Goblin.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here again, as we were talking about The Shining, that the house becomes a character, obviously the truck in the movie, the truck that has no driver, becomes lead. And I will say this, the only disappointing part about that movie is the ending kind of came out of nowhere, and the credits just started rolling, and it explains what had happened. And I feel like they did like three quarters of a movie. And of course, this is what makes it such a crap fest, is like they did this movie and things are going, and it's like, this is what happened at the end. And if they don't show it, they just literally spell it out on the screen in letters telling you what the end of the movie was, which just, I guess that's further makes it why it's such a great bad movie. And of course, you have to be able to love a good bad movie, and Lord knows there are bad movies that I love.
The ending completely it's completely a different tone than the rest of the movie as well. They're on a boat in the water or whatever it is at that point as well, and it's like, really, and that's where we're gonna go with this? At least it wasn't a dream. At least somebody wasn't rubbing their eyes going, it's all been a dream. That would have been the biggest cop-out. Exactly. But you mentioned the truck. So the truck for years, the truck was heavily damaged during the filming of the movie. And I want to say it sat on a lot in Wilmington, North Carolina, where the movie was filmed. And about 10 years ago, maybe a little less, somebody actually rescued it, refurbished it, and it now makes the rounds at a lot of these horror movie conventions.
Wow, that's great.
Pay $15 to sit in the driver's seat. I'll do it. Show me where it is. I'll do it.
Just hope some AC/DC doesn't come on while you're in there, huh?
Exactly. Oh, wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah, that would be fun. But hey, listen, we're kind of getting to the end of the road here on this episode.
Can you believe we didn't mention Carrie once during that entire conversation?
That's true. The original character, not the remake, the original.
Oh, no. Remake, I won't even see it. But and you know what? I would like to discuss at some point, and I should say, too, that Jeff and I talk probably three or four or five times a week, and we always talk about movies, but I want to discuss the Ghostbusters remake at some point, because I'm about to do a major heel turn here and say I actually enjoyed it.
Really?
So Ghostbusters is one of my favorite movies of all time. I was dead set against the remake, and I got to admit, I watched it, and I think it succeeds on a couple of different levels, because it's really not trying to remake the original Ghostbusters. And that was my thing. How do you remake a Bill Murray character? Well, they don't. There is no Bill Murray character in this movie.
Sure.
So, but we'll save that for episode 15 or 20.
And that'll do it for us today. Once again, you can follow me at hashtag Baldrin Jeff on Twitter.
Barry, you out there on the old Twitter?
I am on the old Twitter. I am more of a Facebook guy, but I'm on Twitter and I'm on Instagram as well.
Okay. Well, we'll see you with the funny faces. Don't forget, folks, my book, Breaking Kayfabe, still available. Crowbarpress.com. My friend Scott Teal. I'd like to say thanks to my good friend Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Until next time, for Barry Rose, this is Jeff Bowdrin, Bowdrin the Booker, and we will talk to you folks later.